I don't enjoy pain. I don't enjoy physical pain, and I don't enjoy emotional pain. I don't like being betrayed. I don't like to be hurt. You with me? There might be a few of you that are like, no, that's kind of fun to get hurt, whatever. What do you do when a person or when people hurt you badly? When they wound you deeply? Most of you have someone in your mind right now of a person that has maybe recently or has in the past done damage to you. Intentionally, probably, yes. Last week, we ended the story about Joseph. And in the end of Joseph's life, he displayed a unique ability to forgive. It's rather incredible. His brothers intended for Joseph to be dead. His brothers intended, as Joseph was thrown into the pit by them, they intended, first of all, to kill him, and then they got talked out of it so that the blood would not be on their heads. They said, well, let's just sell him into slavery. We'll make a little bit of money on the side off of him. We'll act like he's dead and take his coat of many colors, and as a play kind of thing, we'll put some blood on it, and we'll take it back to Dad and act all hurried and act, you know, sympathetic. We'll throw water on our faces, look like we're crying. We'll go back to Dad, and we'll tell Dad that Joseph appears to be dead. All the while, Joseph is sitting in the pit, and it seems to me, by the way that Scripture's laid out, by the way that they're telling this story, it seems to me that Joseph's in the pit overhearing the conversation. I come from a family of 9 kids. We didn't fight much. It was 8 brothers and 1 sister, and when we had our little squabbles, they didn't last long. We just kind of pushed and shoved each other and wrestled, and then solved it, and whoever won, won, and you just kind of moved on, and that was how our life was. I couldn't imagine all of my brothers saying to me together, I just want you dead. Our lives would be much better without you. Whew. Maybe you've been through a similar circumstance as Joseph. I don't know. But Joseph handles it in such a unique way that I want to start this morning's message with this. Because here's what Joseph does. Amidst all the pain and anguish, and then you remember last week, we talked about how Joseph, from that point forward, it was about 20 years or so until he's reunited with his brothers. That's a long time for this to fester. And during that time, it wasn't like he had a good life or something. He was sold as a slave, and then he got, remember, Slave of the Month award, right? He got rose to the top, and it's, whoa, I'm Slave of the Month. Whoa, big whoop, right? And then he's falsely accused, thrown into jail. Should have been killed at that point, but for some reason, his master had some mercy on him. He's thrown into jail, and while he's in jail, you remember? Top inmate, inmate of the month award. So on his wall, he's got slave of the month and inmate of the month. What a great thing. Put that on your resume, yeah? No, please take that. Can we have that expunged, please, right? He's got a rough life going on. That's 13 years into it. And then he interprets Pharaoh's dream. He's put in charge, second in charge, right under Pharaoh, to lead them through the time of blessing and prosperity, to save up for the time where after that it's going to be years of famine. His brothers then enter into his life looking for food. They come up to Joseph, not having any clue what he looks like. Joseph is just blown away. Do you remember the last time he saw his brothers? Do you think he had tears in his eyes? As a 17-year-old, Do you think he was trying to choke it back a little bit? Did he ever forget that day? Which day as a slave, which day in prison would he forget about that day and what they said and what they did to him? What day would you forget about that? So here's Joseph, some 20-some years later. Brothers show up. He's just emotionally torn. They intended to hurt him. They wanted him dead. Finally, through a whole set of circumstances, I won't go through it together, but through a whole bunch of circumstances, Joseph comes to this point where he has a conversation with his brothers, and he says to them, guys, get everybody out of the room. I need to tell you a secret. And there's a little bit of panic going on, maybe. And he says to them, I'm Joseph. Remember me? The one, like, you wanted dead? You thought I'm alive, guys. Their responses would be typical, terrified. Oh, this is going to be bad. But Joseph says this amazing thing. We talked about this last week. In Genesis 45, it records how Joseph said, God had this plan. See, God planned this out so that he could save people. Joseph had a unique ability to forgive. You get to the end of the chapter 50 and you see them having a conversation because their father is dead, so they kind of assume that dad was kind of holding things together. Well, dad's dead, and you've seen this in families, right, where the parents die and all of a sudden the family just goes boom, right? So Jacob dies, and then the assumption with the brothers is now Joseph's really going to have it with us, and it's going to get bad. And they come up and they're kind of pleading their case and, hey, have mercy on us. And, man, you know. And Joseph reminds him again and says, guys, I'm not above God. Do you remember? This was God's plan. When's the last time you viewed your hurt through the lens of God's plan? Isn't that a struggle? Honestly, I mean, we're in church, but we can be honest this moment, right? Isn't it hard to view the pain in relationships as God's plan? Isn't it hard to view financial difficulty as God's plan? Isn't it hard to see physical limitations and physical difficulties as God's plan? That God has something going on here. God is intending to do something through this. I don't know what he's going to do. I may never know in this life, but I know that God has a plan. That's where we end. Now, for me, when I look at this, I'm reading it, and the very first time, and still to this day, every time I go through the story of Joseph, it blows me away. The amount of grace, the amount of forgiveness that he shows to his brothers, it blows me away. And for many of you, as we had men's discussion group this week on Monday night, it was awesome. We had a great time discussing this. And throughout the week, I've talked to several guys from that point. And what an incredible, incredible story of Joseph. Forgiveness and grace, and all, it's so outside of our comfort zone even. Because if you hurt me, my intention at that point is, I'm not going to let you hurt me twice. I may turn the other cheek, but I'm going to move back so you don't hit me again, right? Joseph has a unique ability to forgive because he sees it as part of God's plan, what they did. If you were Pharaoh, what would you think of Joseph at this point? It doesn't record it here, but you know me with my crazy imagination that's not been medicated, okay? So with all of this going on, here's what goes on in my mind. I read between the lines a little bit, not to bring and make Scripture be something different, but I read between the lines thinking, who else did this affect? Who else was impacted by Joseph's decision? Because I know today I'm impacted by Joseph's decision, and so have you been, right? But in that day, we find that Joseph is second in charge, and so he's got all kinds of people around him. The person that I think was affected most by Joseph's decision, and I'll say this because of what he did, I think it was Pharaoh. Because what he did was he said, hey, listen, Joseph, if you forgive them, here's the deal. You're an incredible guy. They can just stay here for free. I think, as I look into this text, I think that Pharaoh was blown away. And if you were around Joseph, I don't know that you would be just sitting there passive. You'd be sitting there like, who's this guy? He forgave all of his brothers for that. They wanted him dead. He's hanging out. They're having lunch together. Are you kidding me? So here's where we begin. There's Joseph, a unique relationship with Pharaoh because Pharaoh pours out blessings on him. And he sees all that's happened. He sees that God is huge here. And God's done something miraculous and unique in Joseph's life. And God is uniquely using Joseph to even bring about abundance or show that abundance is coming and show that famine's coming and bring about the even saving, preserving life. So Pharaoh sees Joseph as this unique person. We can say that. Chapter 1 of Exodus is where we begin today. Because in chapter 1, we find, and let me just read through, I'll kind of skip over because there's a whole bunch of names that I really don't want to try to pronounce incorrectly. But in chapter 1 of Exodus, if you want to turn there with me, it's the second book in the Bible. Genesis is first and then Exodus. He says, these are the names of the son of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. And he lists them down there in verse 2 and 3 and 4. And you get to verse 5. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew increased exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Not a problem, right? So here's what happens. Here, you're blessed to be a part of this world over here in Egypt. You can have this land, and they begin to have children. That's what it means to be fruitful and multiply, yes? So they're having babies and having lots of babies, and their families are just growing, and things are just going great, and they become exceedingly strong, and the land was filled with them. So this comes, you remember from this unlikely couple, Abraham and Sarah? You remember the seniors that were infertile, that had children? Okay, that was kind of interesting back there. And then you've got, you know, and it goes through Isaac, and then so Jacob. And so, all right, here's where we are. Joseph. Now, check this out. About 200 years later, as you look at the history, is where you find verse 8. Now there arose... Think back. No, wait, stop. Before you read further, let's think about what 200 years equals, okay? 200 years ago, what was going on in this planet? We have no idea. I don't know. It was 1814. I don't know. It was the War of 1812. That's kind of close. I don't even know who fought who, but it was like history. And I think I passed that test. And it was, I think, France or something. I don't know. Okay, so that's what happened. It was back like 200... We're prone to forgetting, aren't we? And that's what happens here. Now there arose, in verse 8, a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Well, duh. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. We have a problem over here. They keep having kids. And this is becoming a real problem for my kingdom because I think if we do the math, and I think if we really think about this, they could take us. He forgot about Joseph. He forgot about all the things that God did, and so did all of Egypt. This wasn't something that they looked at 200 years later and said, wait a second. You remember, Joseph was this incredible guy, and he remembered his kids, and all. No. God has long since been forgotten 200 years later. He says in verse 10, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." So here's the thing. They're going to deal shrewdly. We're going to change things up here a bit. And what we're going to do is take them as slaves, and we're going to oppress them. And we're going to put them in a position where they've got to work really hard for us and different things. And so that's what's going to happen here. Then you go down further, and they're still what... And you can logically work this through, but I want to be PG here, or G-rated. Logically work through stress and then having babies is an interesting thing. And so that's what happens here. So they begin to have more and more children. And so then he says, we got to get rid of all the male children. What kind of sick individual says it's okay to kill babies? What kind of sick, twisted, hurtful individual would say, let's just kill all the boys? Matter of fact, I'm going to send people in there, and you're just going to obliterate, throw them into the river. I want you to kill all the male boys. Who does that? We read through the text, and it doesn't jump off the page because we've read it before, but when you read it and you really think about what's going on, could you imagine? And so we find tucked into this story this baby that's born from the house of Levi in chapter 2. It's Moses, and they put him into this basket, and they put it into the river. And what happens then is the daughter of Pharaoh comes, and she comes to bathe at the river, which she often does, and she sees this, and here's the baby, and must be a really cute baby, and she says, oh, I got to keep him, takes him back to daddy, and daddy looks at her eyes and looks at her and says, well, I can't say no to her, and so she is able to keep the baby, and so then she's got to find someone to nurse the baby, and who does she find but the baby's mom's. Just like, is God that big? Yes. So then Moses is being raised in the palace. He gets this grand education for free. He gets to be right there next to Pharaoh. Grows up with his children. But then defending his people became an issue when he was around 40 years old. And as he goes to defend his people, he sees one of the taskmasters killing one, hurting his people. And he goes and he kills this taskmaster. He thinks he does it in private, and he doesn't. People see him. Word gets out, and he has to run for his life. So now he's a fugitive. So now he's out in the land, out on the hills there with the Midianites, which is actually part of Abraham's family. It's very interesting how that works out. And so now he's there as a goat herder up on the hill. He's there for about 40 years, and around 80 years old, God comes and shows up. Now, stop just for a second. You've got all this going on 200 years before. God did some mighty things that only God could do. 200 years later, everyone forgot. Do you ever have a problem with forgetting things? As you get older, do you have a problem with forgetting things? That's what I hear. Like, it gets worse as you get older, you know? It's like, I don't know where my keys are. Hey, where's my glasses? And maybe you've done this thing, you know? Have you seen my glasses anywhere? I can't find my... I've looked everywhere for my glasses. Oh, man, I forget where I put them down. And everybody, I haven't seen them. I have no idea where they might be. I don't know where... And, yeah. And then you find that they're on your head, and you're like... Right? We have a tendency to forget, just like all of Egypt did, just like everyone back there. They had a tendency to forget, and so do we. We forget about God. We forget about the great things that God has done in our life. We forget about how amazing God is. We do. Listen, at the end of today's message, if I asked you tomorrow about the message today, you'd say, Man, I forget. What was that about? That was a good, I'm telling you, it was a great message, Pastor. I'm so glad to preach. What was it about? I think forgetting glasses or something like that. That's what I can remember. And okay, so how in the world do you get across to people that forget all the time? How do you get them to remember? What do you do? Benjamin Franklin says this, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember. Involve me and I learn." It's a great quote. Parents, if you're struggling with your children remembering what they're supposed to do next, go brush your teeth. And you find them over in a different room doing something that's so far away from the bathroom where the toothbrush might be. "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember. Let me teach you something, son." Involve me and I learn. How does God do the teaching work in us? He tells us, "I'm God." He teaches us, look at creation. He involves us. I'll never forget what God did. Psalm 19 says, "The testimonies of the Lord are sure." It's the things that are written out for us to see that God is really who He says He is. Have you seen in your life the fact that God can work in you? Maybe you sit and maybe you're like, "Yeah, I'm kind of skeptical about that, and I don't even know about all that today." That's all right. There's people around you that have seen God work in amazing ways. Matter of fact, the Bible is filled with people. That's the testimonies of the Lord. They're simply just saying, this is God's story. Here's Joseph. God had a plan for me. That was it. And now we find Moses right there. You see, God is about to give a lesson to all of us and to the people of Israel and to the whole land that He is God. That He is God. He is about to give them a lesson. He's about to involve them so that they can learn, so that they can see that God is who He says He is. And so the choice for each of us and for them is, do we accept this or do we harden our heart against it? And you find both in the story. So here's what happens. In chapter 3, we find Moses. Let's pick back to where he is. Moses is up on this hill and he's keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And so there's what he's doing. The best conversation he has there is with his sheep, goats, whatever, and being a shepherd. Then the Lord does this amazing thing. He sets this bush on fire, but it doesn't go out. So it gets Moses' attention. Moses comes over, and God says to him, "Moses," and this is verse 4 and 5, He says, "Moses," he said, here I am. Then in verse 5, he says, "Don't come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." Verse 6, "And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God." Verse 7, "Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of Canaanites, Hivites, Amorites," and so on. Verse 9, "And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them." Now, this would be akin to how Moses felt when he left. He didn't want to see them oppressed either, so this is resonating within him. This is something that would be exciting to him. Wow, this is great. I'm not sure why you're telling me this, God, but this is awesome, great plan. I can't wait to see this. Great. Oh, man. And the thrill of his heart had to be huge, not only being in the presence of God, but also hearing God's plan first. Verse 10. Now, if you haven't heard this story, you're going to look at this maybe different. If you've heard this, let me challenge you to look at this and see what he's really saying to him. Verse 10. "Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. See, here's God's story. He's calling Moses to be his ambassador for deliverance. Here's what he's doing. I'm going to call you to be my ambassador. So he calls Moses, and here's Moses' response. Isn't this great? I mean, if you're in Moses' shoes, what do you say here? Moses, I know you're fugitive. I know you're kind of on the run here. I know you're relaxed in this nice, you know, shepherd kind of deal. But time for a change of occupation. Time to move you from this place to that. I am choosing you to bring the people of Israel out of this oppression. Verse 11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" So God calls Moses, but Moses made excuses. Excuse number one, who am I? Who am I? I'm nobody. I'm nobody. I mean, look at me. I'm a fugitive. Everybody should forget about me. You've never used an excuse like this, right? I'm not famous enough. I'm not big enough. I'm a nobody. Excuse number two. Oh, and here's what God says. Verse 12, he said, "But I will be with you. But I will be with you. This shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Then they have this conversation going on, and I would encourage you to read it, and I hope that you've read already. Now, let's go a little further here, chapter 4, verse 1. God's responding, saying, no, you don't understand. I know, I get your excuse, who am I? I get that, but I'm going to be with you. And he goes in and shares with him how he'll be with him, and he's going to show him his mighty hand, and he's going to strike Egypt down. Chapter 4, Moses answered, "But behold, they won't believe me. They're not going to believe me. There's no, I mean, look at me. I'm not a believable person. They didn't believe me 40 years ago. Why do you think they'd ever believe me now?" So God's response in verse 2, the Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" I love how God answers this. What's in your hand?
I don't know, got nothing.
He said, "A staff." He said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. I'm glad God didn't do this test with me, because I would have been gone. Like burning bush and sandals and everything. I don't care. That's a snake. See you, bye. Not Moses, right? He throws it down on the ground and it becomes a serpent. And he did. He runs from it a little bit. So, but the Lord said to Moses, I think this is God's sense of humor. Don't you see that? Like, God's funny. It could have been like could have turned into a rabbit, like a nice cuddly little rabbit. Oh, it's a nice cuddly rabbit. That's great. A snake. Anyway, all right. Sorry. See, I just, medication. It's, okay. So verse 4, "But the Lord said, put your hand out and catch it by the tail." I'd be running for it. Okay. So he put out his hand and he caught it and it became a staff in his hand. Verse 5, "That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God..." Wow. Again, the Lord said, "Put your hand inside your cloak." Now, this would be cool. Okay, all right. You're not going to have a snake in my coat. Please, Lord. No, not. So he puts his hand in his coat. And he put his hand in his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. This is an incurable disease. Then God said, "Put your hand back inside your cloak." What would you do? The last time I did that, Lord, that turned into leprosy, and I'm a snake, rabbit, I don't know, but this is getting kind of scary and spooky, but okay, Lord, if that's what you want. So he put his hand back in his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Verse 8, "If they will not believe you," God said, "or listen the first to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. They will not believe even those two signs or listen to your voice. You shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Would that be enough to convince you to go if you're Moses? Would God doing miracles in and around you be enough for you to go? Excuse number three. Verse 10. But Moses said, "Oh my Lord, I am not eloquent either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." This is excuse number three. I'm not eloquent. I'm not a public speaker. Do you know the two greatest fears in America? And they flip-flop depending on who you are. Fear number one is a fear of death. Fear number two is fear of public speaking. So in other words, if you have to do a eulogy for someone at a funeral, you're not sure which one is worse, the fear of being the guy that's there or the fear of speaking about the guy that's there. Either way, you're in a bad situation. Here's Moses. I'm not eloquent. You're calling me to be a public speaker? Are you kidding me? This is a problem. Don't you see that as such? Verse 11. Even today, even if I were to ask you and say, how many of you like to speak in public? You'd raise your hand because those that like to would raise your hand. But if I ask it opposite and said, how many of you don't like to speak in public? A few of you would raise your hand quickly, and then there's others that are so timid about being in public and being a spectacle, you'd be nervous about raising your hand until I called on you and asked, and then you'd be like, oh, don't do this to me, please. Okay, so you get the point. Verse 11. The Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute, a deaf, or a seeing, or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Oh, man, Moses is in trouble. Verse 12, now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. But he said, oh my Lord, please send someone else. Then verse 14, this is a bad day now. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Now he goes and he calls Aaron to be his spokesperson, and Aaron proves actually to be a problem for Moses down the road. Here's my point. Moses makes three huge excuses to God for following God's call. God's calling Moses, and Moses kept saying, I can't do it. I just can't. No, you got the wrong guy. I can't do that. I don't have the skill set that you're looking for. I know what you need, but you got the wrong guy. Can you go to, like, the neighbor? He's pretty good at talking in public. And maybe, like, can I just make an application? How have you responded to God's call? I know, here's the pushback. I didn't see a burning bush. God never spoke directly. I know. But God has given us instructions over and over and over. Here's who he is, here's what he's done, and here's his call on your life. And for each one of us, it's slightly different, but it's about the same. Here, let me ask you about this call. You ready? Just can I pick on a couple of things? You're struggling in a relationship because they've done harm to you and they've hurt you. What's God's call? Isn't it grace, love, and mercy toward this individual? Isn't it to be like Joseph and to say, God has a plan? Isn't it to have that unique ability to forgive that person that's hurt you? Because God is that big. Yeah, but Pastor, you don't know what happened. Really, there's no way you went through a worse case scenario than Joseph. I find many people are willing to give up on their relationships that God wants to bless them in because it's just too hard. And they make excuse number one, but God, you don't understand how bad it is. Really? But God, you don't understand. Like I'm going to try to do this, and they don't trust me. They're not going to believe that I'm just being loving and kind. Nothing's ever going to change. Really? I don't even know what to say. And I wonder how often it is that we, as God's people who are called by His name, I wonder how often it is as we are followers of Christ, we make excuses. And we kind of just, everybody's doing it this way, God. Like all of the Moseses have said no. But I went to church. Well, I'm glad you did. God's call in our life is to follow Him all the way through. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy road, and for Moses it wouldn't be. But here, finally, Moses relinquishes and he says, okay, I'll go. And he takes him and he says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you this opportunity to walk into this land, and you're going to take my people out to worship me. Okay, what's the game plan, God? Now think about this, and I'm going to go through this really fast. What's the game plan? Here's the game plan. You ready? You're going to go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh, well, he's got a hard heart against me. He doesn't believe in me. I mean, look at what he's doing to my people anyway. He's a pretty sick guy. So here's what he's going to do. He's already got a hard heart. He's going to harden it worse, and then I'm going to harden it as well. So he's going to say no. So I'm going to send a plague that's going to plague them. I'm going to get his attention and show that I am God. And then you're going to come back and we're going to work this thing out. And it's just going to keep on going. And he warns him and he says, if you don't let the people go, and this is chapter 4, verse 22 and 23, he says, Israel is my firstborn son. I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. So here's God's game plan. What's Moses got to do? He's got to talk. He doesn't have to come with a bazooka. He's not bribing him. There's no money involved. He's coming as just a simple speaker saying, hey, God says let his people go, so let them go. And Pharaoh's going to harden his heart. So here's what God does. He sends plagues, 10 of them. He starts by turning the water into blood. This lasted for 7 days. And finally, Pharaoh's like, okay, all right. And then he goes back, and then God makes everything good, and he doesn't let the people go. Then he sends another plague. And this is the frogs. Could you imagine frogs being everywhere, in everything? You're having rice, and all of a sudden a frog pops out, you know, or whatever. There's frogs just everywhere. And that's what happens, and Pharaoh's heart is hardening against God, and then he finally says, okay, and God says, he takes the frogs out, and then he doesn't let the people go, and then gnats come in, and could you imagine gnats everywhere? Fruit flies, do you guys have fruit flies going on? Yeah. They must be bad right now. I don't know what the deal is, but they're annoying. Could you imagine gnats being everywhere? Like in this church, could you imagine how annoying that would be? It's so bad. Like, there's nothing comfortable. And so finally he relinquishes, and he says, okay, I'll let him go. And then he changes his mind. Then there's flies, and cattle are dead, and then there's boils on everyone, and then hail comes, and he spares his people, and locusts, and then darkness, and we find Pharaoh just continuing to harden his heart till you get to plague number 10. So plague number 10 is interesting because he stops and he says, okay, now listen, Moses is really important. Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go and I'm going to kill all the firstborn children. But those that make the sacrifice and put the blood on the doorpost, I will send the angel of death around and will kill all the firstborn except for those that are covered by the blood. You can be passed over this. And then, by the way, we're going to call this the Passover, and you're going to remember this for all generations to come. And do they still remember this? Do we still remember this? Yes, this is a current thing that's still being remembered today. This is going back a few thousand years, so this is a pretty cool deal. 3,500 years later, we're still doing it. Now, this is a foreshadowing of Christ. Do you see it? He's going to give his firstborn son for us. Amazing. The blood will be shed for us. He will pay for all of our sins so that those that put their faith in him will be passed over the wrath of God. It's awesome. Now, without going into a whole lot of detail, because you know me, I could spend 3 months on this passage alone. So without going into a ton of detail, let me just suffice it to say this one thing. In order for them to have this angel pass over them, they had to have action associated with belief. They could have said, oh man, I believe that's, yep, that's what's going to happen. We're going to be saved from that. And yeah, that's going to be great. Passover, no problem. This will be great. And then do nothing about it, not actually follow through with the specific things that God told them to be doing. Without any action, faith is dead. It's just mere faith. It's just, well, I kind of believe this. But over here, he's calling them not only to believe and have faith that's in God that he's going to protect and he's going to do what he says he's going to do. It's over here that there's action attributed to this faith. The book of James, half-brother of Jesus, writes this about faith and works. He says, without works, faith is dead. He says, you've got to have faith, yes, but you have to have works associated with it. It should go hand in hand. A person that believes in Jesus Christ, then fast forwarding back up to our day, a person that believes in Jesus Christ as their Savior not only says, yep, I believe, because Satan could do the same thing. Yeah, I believe Jesus, he resurrected. I know all about that. Yeah, I get that. But instead of simply belief, there's a life change. That because of what he did for us, because of where he is, and because of his great grace and mercy in my life, I'm a changed man. My life is different. When someone hurts me, instead of retaliating and hurting them back, instead of doing all that, instead of I look at Joseph and say, well, that was unique, but I think that's what I should be doing. God's got a plan. You hurt me. You fired me. You did this to me. You okay, well, fine. Fine. It's God's plan. And whatever, like, I forgive you because God's got a bigger plan than you, and you're just like a pawn, sort of, you know? Actions had to accompany belief with the Israelites, and today it's the same. Actions have to accompany belief. If all we ever do is we say, yep, I believe, and that's as far as we go, then we've missed everything. Because by believing in Jesus Christ as the one who has been our substitute for our sin, it is a life-changing step of saying, you're my Lord. Because essentially, in saying all of this, we're saying, God, you know what's best. I want to be with you. So you know what's best. I'm just going to follow you. Now, it's not that this over here, the works aspect is what saves you. That's not it. This identifies what has happened in your heart. It just gives evidence. A person who gets baptized, why do they get baptized? It is your first step of public obedience where you're saying, you know what, I'm going public with what God has done inside of me. That's how God works. So here the Israelites had to take, and they had to take the blood and put it up on the doorpost, and then the angel of death, it passed over them by their faith and their action that they put associated with that, all of that, and then they walk out free from Pharaoh, because Pharaoh says, get them out of my sight. I don't want them anywhere around me. Get them out. But then God's not done. God's not done. Because God, through his miraculous ability, kills Pharaoh and his army. Opens the river, Israelites go through, Pharaoh says, let's follow him, charge, and they get in the middle, and Moses then puts his staff down, and the water comes and kills them all. so that they would remember that he is God. You know, God was doing all of this to deliver his children from the evil all around him. God's still in that business today. I hope that you've come to a point where you can see that this is all a picture. It's a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ. It's a simple picture. Here's what Jesus did. Jesus was sent. He was called by God to come and to give his life for all of ours. He lived absolutely perfect. He died on the cross, paid for all of the sin of the world, rose again the third day, showing that he has conquered sin and death. And by faith, we take the step and say, I believe, as it says in Romans chapter 10, verse 9, I confess with my mouth that Jesus Christ is my Lord, and I believe in my heart. It's belief, and it's open confession. He is my Lord, he's my master, he's in charge of everything. It's that instead of me being in charge, he's in charge. Whatever you say is what goes. I'm good with that. God, you've got a plan, I'll follow. And for most of you, you come say, I know, that's kind of like a repeat. I get this message. I've been here and done that. So here's my statement. Don't forget. Don't forget. Don't forget what he's done. And don't forget what he's called you to do. So often, I look around, and my frustration today is that I look at so many Christians, so many people that say, I'm over here, I believe that Jesus Christ died for my sins, and I look over here and I see a world of people that say, I believe in Jesus, that don't live anywhere near what he would say. Forgiveness? Come on, really? I'm not doing that. That's crazy. They hurt me once. It's better off me not being around them. And the amount of bitterness and hardness looks identical to Pharaoh. God's called me to have a marriage like that. God's called me to put him first in my finances. God's called me to do... Are you kidding me? But I thought God was a God of love. Yes, he loved you that much that he would go through an extreme amount of pain for you and for me so that we would not live any longer in a way that's outside of him, but we would live in a way that we believe that he is Jesus Christ. We believe that he is our Savior, and we live like it. It changes us. And then we understand his calling on our life is to be who he has called us to be his holy people, to walk like this in our lives with people around us. Don't forget. When God calls you to do something, he enables you to do it. And didn't he do that with Moses? I'm not eloquent. They're not going to believe me. How in the world is this going to happen? I don't have a bank account. I got nothing here. And God says, just go. Go. And here's what God does. He shows up as God does, and God takes care of it one after another, after another, after another, after another. When God calls you to do something, he will enable you to do it. When God calls you to do something, he will enable you to do it. I don't care how old or how young you are. When God calls you to do something, he will enable you to do it. Does that mean it's going to be easy and everything's going to be wonderful? No. What that means is that you're going to understand who God is and let him work in and through your life. And we should be saying, yes, that's what I want. Leonard Ravenhill, a preacher from almost 100 years ago, said this. One of these days, some simple soul will pick up the book of God, read it, and believe it. Then the rest of us will be embarrassed. D.L. Moody talked about the fact that if one person actually followed God and had the faith to believe and take steps of faith with God, the world would be changed by that one individual. I look and say, regardless of how many people affects, are we following the call that God has on our life? Or are we just playing games? We talk about the day being late, the hour being late, and you look at all the atrocities and all the pain that's going on in the world, in our culture and in cultures all over the place. The hour's late. The world needs God. We need God. Over the summer, we went swimming over a friend of ours' house, and Our family went over there, and they have a nice pool. One's got the deep end, and one side's deep, and then the other side's shallow. It's like 3 feet or so. And Ethan, our four-year-old, loves to get in the water. He just enjoys dirty or getting in the water, any of those things. He's a very active child. And so here's what we did over the summer as we got into different pools. We went on vacation and stuff. We had him get in the shallow side, and here's what he did. He stayed right around the steps. This is where he wanted to be, because he'd get out and jump in and get out and jump in about 3,000 times in an hour, okay? That's just what he did. He has a lot of energy. I have no idea where he might get that from, but he'd get out and jump in and get out and jump in, and we just kind of sit there inside and watch him get out and jump in, get out and jump in. And so we're there with our friends and just hanging out by the pool and talking and stuff like that, and this is what Ethan's doing. He's getting out and jumping in, getting out and jumping in, getting out and jumping in, and getting everybody wet around, and I don't know what to say. If you're at a pool and you get wet by my son splashing around because he's jumping, tough, get over it, because you're in this pool to get wet. So he's getting out something, and then he wanted to get a drink, and so he goes and gets a drink, and we're all just kind of sitting around the side talking, and Ethan comes down, and we've been warning him, this is the deep end, you can't go in over here, just stay over here, this is where you have to be. And we showed him where the line was and how it has a ramp that goes down like this, and so we told him all about that, right? So we're sitting there talking, and he must have forgotten about our conversation, because he comes around the pool, and he gets to the point where, like, right here is the line of where the deep and the shallow goes like this, and he jumps in at the about 4-foot part on the slant going down. He was in too deep. His feet hit the ground, and I'm watching. I see all of this happening right in front of me. His feet hit the ground and his head's under. So he's going, and he's doing this number. What am I doing? Swim! You'll be all right, son. Take it like a man. Yep. That's my boy over there. Is that what I did? I went inside, got my swimming trunks on, took the shoes off. Is that what I did? You're about to throw a hymn book on me, so let me not stop here. Because of my love for my son, because I couldn't see him being in any more pain, and because I didn't want anything bad to happen, even though he forgot what I said, even though he totally ignored everything we said earlier, even though it was all his fault, I didn't hesitate for a moment to jump in and to grab him. That's what this is about. You see, we've ignored God's call. We've ignored God. And this is a call to remember. You jumped in the deep end, and God doesn't say, it serves you right. God says, I love you. I got you. And maybe this morning you're in a relationship, or you're in a difficult time, or you're physically going through it. Whatever you might be going through that you say, I just don't know that I can get through this. Listen, don't forget, when God calls you to do something, he enables you to do it. So if you're at the end of your rope saying, I just want to give up on this relationship, I want to give up on doing this thing right, I want to give up, I just can't do this anymore, listen, stop. Don't be like Moses and give God excuses. Just go up to it and say, okay, God, you've called me to do this. So God, you're going to enable me somehow, in some way, and it might be painful, it might be difficult, it might be even embarrassing. You might even call me to speak publicly, I don't know. But God, whatever you want to do, you're going to enable me in your time to do it. Don't forget. Romans chapter 8 talks about God's love being so great that there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God. There's absolutely nothing. Read through this whole chapter. It's a phenomenal chapter. you get to the end. He says, there's nothing, whether it's principalities and powers of the air and all this other thing, famine and pestilence, all that, nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. Why? It's far above all of that. Listen, even though maybe you've jumped in the deep end, and maybe that's where you are, and you just pushed up and you got your head above water and you take a breath and you're like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Would you call out to God and say, God, help? You know what I learned that day? I learned that drowning victims don't call for help. I didn't know that. You see, Ethan didn't cry out for help. He was too busy trying to get his head above water. You know what's amazing? God doesn't even need me to cry out for help. He wants us to. He wants us to call to him. And sometimes it's just that look of desperation, and sometimes it's that panic, and it's just saying, I don't even know what to say, God. I don't know what to say, God, but please. Maybe that's where you are. You don't know where to go, don't know what to say. Listen, would you from your heart and your mind just say, Lord, please, help. Remember, don't forget. If God's called you to this, if he's called you to that marriage, if he's called you to that finance, if he's called you to that job, if he's called you to this church, if he's called you to this community, if he's called you, he will enable you to do it, so don't quit. Don't quit. Let's pray. God, thank you that you don't quit on us. Thank you, God, that all the things that we've been through, all the times that we've jumped in the deep end, God, thank you that you don't ignore us and just walk away, but Lord, you run to us. So God, thank you. I pray that, Lord, those that are struggling in different ways, I pray that even right now you'd give each and every one of us the courage to follow your call. To follow your call. Lord, enable us to even take that step. And it's through Jesus I can pray this. Amen.